So, Miss, what brings you here?
I'm scared that my husband's going to kill me.
Okay. So you're just afraid.
I know that he'll do that.
Whoa. How do you know that?
Because I know.
What? All right. You're making a comment. How do you know?
Because he told me.
As a viewer that just started watching this video, you may be wondering how someone has found themselves in this frightening and vulnerable position. Well, the answer to that question actually began 13 years earlier. On the evening of January 6th, 2006, at approximately 11:30 p.m., the Crestview Police Department received a chilling 911 call.
I ran in and she got into the house and Melissa's dead on the living room floor.
Okay, if she's unconscious, she's not talking to you, anything?
No, there's blood everywhere.
Okay, is she breathing? Can you get a pulse of any kind?
I haven't even touched her, no ma'am. I didn't want to mess with nothing. She's been murdered.
The caller's name was Christopher Cadenhead, and the woman that was found dead in her home was 33-year-old Melissa Howard. Chris was just stopping by Melissa's place while he headed on his way to a hunting trip. When he arrived at the house at 11:15 p.m., he was surprised to see Melissa's 15-year-old daughter, Carrie Winkler, and her boyfriend, Daniel, waiting on the front porch. Carrie found herself locked out of the house, and like Christopher, had tried to contact Melissa without any luck. As the three waited on the porch, they tried several ways to get into Melissa's house. After about 15 minutes, Daniel was finally able to unlock the front door using a FedEx ID card.
I used FedEx ID card, like a credit card, to open the bottom lock, and I opened the door.
The moment the door swung open, Carrie rushed inside, only to be confronted with the sight of her mother's lifeless body lying on the floor, in the middle of what looked like a ransacked home. Shocked by what she had just seen, the 15-year-old rushed back outside before Christopher could even step foot inside. After seeing Melissa himself, he then used Carrie's phone to call 911. They quickly dispatched other officers to the scene.
There's been a shooting there, ma'am. Is this Crestview PD? The victim who has been shot is Melissa Howard.
Despite Chris initially believing that Melissa had been shot, the EMTs later confirmed that she had actually been stabbed in the neck. The wounds were so deep and precise that they had impacted her spine. In most murder cases, the first suspect is usually the victim's spouse or romantic partner, and this case was no different. Although Christopher Cadenhead was married to another woman, he quickly admitted that he and Melissa were having an affair. So, detectives wondered if Christopher or Melissa's ex-husband, Brian Howard, were involved in her death. Since Chris was having an affair, detectives presumed that his motive could have been to hide said affair from his wife. However, during the 911 call, Christopher can be overheard in the background having a conversation with his wife on his own cell phone.
Oh my God. Sherry, come to Crestview.
This call to his wife and apparent confession regarding his affair seemed to eliminate any motive for Chris to kill Melissa. So detectives decided to focus on Brian as their main suspect. Homicide detective and lead investigator Kenny Pinkard from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement described the crime scene as clean and lacking any evidence, which led him to believe that the murder was executed by a professional hitman. But why would Brian hire a professional hitman? About 3 years prior to Melissa's tragic death, she had gone through a divorce with her ex-husband, Brian. The separation then led to a prolonged and emotionally draining custody battle over their son. After the court ruled in Melissa's favor, Brian was visibly upset by the verdict and decided to disregard the court's decision. This initiated a second legal battle. Despite going through several hearings, the court ruled in Melissa's favor again. However, this didn't put a stop to Brian's harassment, and Melissa would go on to tell many friends that she was worried about what Brian might do next. But on the evening of Melissa's murder, Brian was at a family birthday party at a well-known local Mexican restaurant called Azteca. Multiple witnesses, including family members, other patrons, and order receipts, helped confirm that he was there. In fact, Brian had actually arranged for Melissa to drop off their son at the restaurant, which seemed to strengthen his alibi. On top of Brian's seemingly solid alibi, the forensic team was also facing significant challenges in their investigation. Not only were they unable to locate any fingerprints at the scene, but they were also unable to extract any DNA from the sweater that Melissa was wearing. Since the sweater was completely soaked in her own blood, it was nearly impossible to isolate any other DNA profiles. They did, however, notice that a recently installed security camera looked as if it may have been tampered with, and that her diary was missing. Still, they had nothing that could directly connect Brian Howard to the crime scene. Despite the absence of physical evidence, there was an abundance of circumstantial evidence potentially tying Brian to the crime. However, for the time being, the police decided to focus on other potential suspects. The third person that they wanted to speak to was a man named Russell Holbrook, who Melissa's daughter claimed had been by the house a couple days earlier. So they contacted Russell and asked him to stop by the police station for a short interview. The first thing that they asked him was when he had last seen Melissa.
When's the last time you actually saw Melissa? Days, months, a couple years, yeah.
They then told him that Carrie had already advised them that he had come by the house a couple days before her mother's murder. He then immediately changed his story.
Yeah, I stopped by there.
Aside from Russell's suspicious lie, law enforcement went on to hit dead end after dead end. And without any concrete evidence pointing to one specific killer, the case of Melissa Howard went cold for 13 years. Let's now fast forward to May of 2015. A new agent, Megan Palumbo, took over the case from Detective Dennis Haley, and the investigation was reopened. Initially, investigators suspected that Melissa was assaulted from the front near the door. However, Palumbo's theory suggested that the attack occurred from behind. This theory prompted a re-examination of the DNA on the back of the sweatshirt. In doing so, investigators were now able to use a new DNA testing process, which could determine a DNA profile using a smaller sample size. This process located a new DNA profile on a cleaner portion of the sweater, and the profile was immediately sent in for identification. 2 weeks later, the lab results uncovered that the new DNA profile did not belong to Melissa or her ex-husband. Instead, it seemed to match the DNA of Brian's best friend, Michael Holbrook. Although not an exact match, the DNA was found to be familial, suggesting that it could belong to a close male relative of Michael. And if you've been paying attention, you may recognize Michael's last name. Russell Holbrook, Michael's brother and a friend of Brian, was one of the three initial suspects who were looked into back in 2006. And not only did Russell lie to the police during his interview, he was also the only suspect who had previously refused to undergo a DNA test. By this time, Russell had moved to Huntsville, Alabama, when Florida detectives arrived at his doorstep with a warrant to obtain his DNA. Detective Ralph Garrett noticed a dramatic change in Russell's demeanor, stating that it looked like his heart leaped from his chest into his throat. The results of the DNA test confirmed that the DNA found on the sweater was an exact match to Russell's DNA, marking a significant breakthrough in the investigation. But now there was another question. Was Michael with Russell when the murder took place? A surveillance video obtained from a local Walmart captured the Holbrook brothers together shortly after the time of the murder. In the footage, Michael can be observed examining his hands, possibly indicating the presence of blood on them. When confronted with this footage, Michael told the police that the two had gone to the store to purchase medicine for Russell's girlfriend's child, and that he was only looking at the dry skin on his hands. As the investigators closed in on the brothers, a warrant was obtained to tap both of their phones. Utilizing a technique referred to as tickling the wire, detectives strategically leaked details regarding the DNA results to some of Michael's friends. Their aim was to have that information get back to Michael and provoke a phone call between the brothers that could offer crucial insights into the case. What you're about to hear is a phone conversation between Russell and Michael. Russell now makes it very clear that he did in fact visit Melissa's home just 2 days prior to her death.
Can you talk? Yeah, I got a few minutes.
I went to her house and talked to her.
Went to Missy's house?
Yeah.
So you've been to her house before?
Yes.
So, I mean, then it's possible that your DNA's in her house.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have been all over hers.
No, of course not. It's over there getting a piece, but...
Yeah, I went.
Oh, man, it's like we said, they're trying to scare me. So now they're telling everybody in Okaloosa County that they have me dead to rights. No, he says they got some new DNA technology. He showed me a paper saying they have your DNA in multiple places on her body, and that I have put myself with you. But
right.
He showed me. Yeah, he had a paper about it. You're 1 in 39 million. Your DNA was all over her body. Yada yada yada.
I mean, that doesn't make sense.
I mean, it don't make sense. And that's what I told him. It didn't make sense to me either. And I kept saying, well, what
what's all this got to do with me? And he just kept saying, well, you know, we got you on video with him at Walmart, so you was there too. He told me, he said, you know, we just wanted to give you this one last chance, you know, to give a statement. And I was just saying I was with you to protect you from your wife.
Well, they're trying to say you and I planned it.
Right.
Premeditating. So then they get you as principal and get me as capital.
Although they spoke rather cryptically, detectives believed that this conversation suggested that the two men acted together. However, at this point in the investigation, the detectives had only gathered sufficient evidence against Russell to secure a warrant for his arrest. On November 8, 2016, Russell Holbrook was formally charged with the first-degree murder of Melissa Howard.
A Florida grand jury has returned an indictment in a murder case involving a local woman, Melissa Howard, that had gone unsolved for almost 13 years. David Russell Holbrook Jr. was arrested in Alabama and returned today to Florida to stand trial on charges for first-degree murder.
Detectives hoped that Russell would negotiate a plea deal and, in doing so, implicate both Michael and Brian. They were convinced that Brian had solicited the Holbrook brothers to murder Melissa Howard. During Brian's interview at the time of the murder, Brian made a peculiar statement. There was a rumor that I was supposed to kill Russell's wife, and in return, Russell was supposed to kill my wife. This odd remark led officers to suspect that this might have indeed been the plan. Russell rejected any plea deal, refused to incriminate others, and was prepared to proceed to trial. On February 19, 2019, 13 years after the murder of Melissa Howard, Russell Holbrook's trial finally began. Clifton Drake, the state attorney, began his opening statement by presenting the connections between Melissa Howard and the two significant men in her life at the time of her tragic death. The backdrop to this case was a bitter custody dispute between the former couple, which Melissa had won. Drake pointed out that Melissa was set to assume custody on the very day of her untimely death, a fact he stressed to the jurors.
You will hear through the course of the trial that there was an ongoing custody battle between Brian Howard and Melissa Howard over primary custody of Taylor. He was about 11 years old at the time. Primary custody was with Brian Howard, and Melissa Howard was seeking to have primary custody with her.
Drake addressed the pivotal role of DNA findings in building the case against Russell. While he acknowledged that some of the DNA samples had encountered contamination, Drake sought to play down the impact of this issue on the case's validity.
You will hear testimony from Jennifer Hatler that when she compared Russell Holbrook's DNA to the male DNA on Melissa Howard's sweatshirt, it matched. You will hear her testify that the frequency of occurrence of those two being a match is 1 in 39 million people. You will also learn, during my case, maybe during the defense, that a DNA contamination occurred in this case. And I will be presenting testimony of exactly what happened. And you will hear Ms. Hatler explain what happened, what it means, and how it was dealt with.
The argument that DNA test results may be contaminated is often used by defense attorneys as a core tactic to challenge the validity of a DNA match. This piece of information played a crucial role in Holbrook's defense, with defense attorney John Jarvis highlighting it during his opening statement.
They admit that there was a contamination done by this very analyst. I think that that testimony is going to be out there. And a contamination occurred during this investigation of this trial. Russell was at her house 2 days prior. His DNA, touch DNA, could have been left there. He could have sat on the couch, and he could have left some DNA there or any other ways could have been left there. And Melissa Howard could have sat down on the same couch, and I think the evidence is going to show that's a possibility that could have occurred.
On top of the questionable DNA evidence, Jarvis also went on to point out that no clear motive had been established as to why exactly Russell Holbrook would want to murder Melissa.
We're all unable to produce a motive for Russell to commit this crime. 13 years, could produce one, no motive. Absolutely no motive.
The defense then wrapped up their case and asked the jury for a verdict of not guilty. Going back to the DNA, the prosecution then called senior crime lab analyst Jennifer Hatler to the stand. Jennifer explained to the jury that the contamination was quickly identified and that the evidence should still be trusted.
My name is Jennifer Hatler.
Ms. Hatler, where are you employed?
I'm employed at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement in the biology and DNA section.
Now, Mrs. Hatler, we've talked about a contamination that occurred in this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
It turns out that the contamination was actually from a pair of scissors that had not yet been cleaned after being used in a different investigation. Once she realized the error, she used a second sample that was not contaminated and testified that she felt the evidence was enough to confirm Russell's presence at the crime scene.
The partial foreign DNA profile matched the DNA profile from David Russell Holbrook. The frequency of occurrence of the partial DNA profile for unrelated individuals is 1 in 39 million.
After explaining the contamination issue, the prosecution directed their focus onto witness testimony. Carrie Winkler, Melissa's daughter, who was just 15 years old at the time, was the first person to discover Melissa's lifeless body. During the trial, she was asked about that tragic moment.
What happened once the door was opened? It's okay, ma'am. Take your time.
Once we were able to open the door, I went into the front foyer and I turned the light on.
What did you see once there was better light?
My mom lying there.
Could you describe the layout of what you could see and where you saw your mom's body?
The foyer is in the very front, which opens up to the living room. And we had a huge entertainment center on the back wall, and she was lying on the wall all the way across.
What did you do once you realized that your mom was there?
I ran back out.
After explaining the heartbreaking events of that evening, she was asked if Russell had spent any other time at their house other than the visit that took place just 2 days before the murder.
Was there any other time that Russell was at your house other than that Wednesday night?
No.
Why not?
Russell was not allowed out of our house. He was considered one of Brian Howard's friends. And my mother was going through a custody battle with Brian Howard. He had made several threats on her life. She considered Russell to be his friend and dangerous. She said that she had caught him at her house before with a gas can, and I was to never let him nor any of Brian's friends at our home, inside the home, ever.
As Carrie's questioning wrapped up, the prosecution's case against Russell seemed stronger than ever. And that's when Melissa's married boyfriend was called to the stand.
How long had you been seeing Melissa Howard before she died?
Right at 3 months. Exactly 3 months, I believe.
What time, roughly, did you arrive at Melissa's house?
I believe it was 11:13.
Was anyone there when you arrived?
Yes, her daughter Carrie and a guy she had gone on a date with, Daniel, was under the front porch light, huddled together. And Carrie said that they can't get her to answer the door, but we could hear her phone ringing inside. And I went around to the left side of the house to see if her bathroom light was on, and it wasn't. By the time I turned around and started to head back to the front, Daniel had jimmied the front door lock loose with a FedEx card. And when my eyes did adjust, I could see Melissa lying on the floor in the living room.
What was your reaction when you saw her?
At first, I thought she had a seizure or something medically was wrong.
Did there come a point where you thought something different had happened?
Yes, sir. I walked in, and the closer I got to her, I could tell that there was a pool of blood around her head. She was face down.
Did anyone call 911?
I did.
What phone did you use?
I used Carrie's phone because I believe I asked her to call, and she, I don't know if she was shaking and couldn't call, but I remember taking the phone from her and calling 911.
Although his testimony seemed very genuine, Russell's attorneys worked to paint Chris as an alternative suspect. They did this by focusing on Christopher's extramarital affair, suggesting that it could have been a motive for the murder.
I guess Melissa Howard knew that you were married, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And there was some talk that you were going to be leaving your wife, isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. I was pretty much heading out the door, yes, sir.
Okay. And you had kind of indicated to her, Miss Melissa Howard, that you wanted to be with her, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, were you ever aware of any pregnancy tests being taken?
I was not.
Okay. Were you ever discussed or had any law enforcement officers ever confront you with that, the possibility that there might have been some pregnancy tests?
My first statement at the end of January, it was brought up about that, and I had nothing about it because she had told me her tubes were tied, and her neighbor said that she had to take that to something to do with her meds she was taking. She had to take a pregnancy test after taking meds. I don't know what meds.
But you were confronted by FDLE agents with the possibility that she was taking a pregnancy test, or they asked you about that, didn't they?
They asked me if I knew that there was one in the garbage can, and I had no idea.
But you were questioned on it?
Yes, they did ask me about it.
All right.
The defense then brings up the clip found in the background of the 911 call, where Chris can be heard telling his wife about the murder. This is the clip, to be precise.
Oh my God. Sherry, come to Chris.
Using this clip, they then push Chris even more by focusing on the circumstances surrounding his confession to his wife about the affair.
She didn't know what you were doing over at the dead woman's house either, did she?
She had no idea.
But so she finds out on this night that you're having an affair, and not only are you having an affair, but you're having an affair with this dead woman that you discover. Is that right?
Yes.
Although there is a possibility that this push to paint Chris as an alternative suspect was successful, at this point, the prosecution still seemed to be coming out on top. The next person called to the stand was Melissa's son, Taylor Howard, now 20 years old and had been raised by his dad, Brian, following the death of his mother.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Would you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Taylor Howard, Melissa Howard's son.
Mr. Howard, could you angle that microphone towards you a little bit? It bends a little bit.
Thank yes,
you,
sir. No problem.
How old are you, sir?
I'm 24.
How old were you in January of 2006?
I was 11.
What grade were you in?
I was in fourth grade.
The prosecution asked him to recount the details of his last interaction with Melissa.
I'd like to ask you specifically about Friday, January 6th of 2006.
Yes, sir.
When did you see her?
I went home that day after school. She got off work a couple hours after, and she came home, and I was there for a couple hours. We played some board games, and she wound up taking me to a dinner with my dad and his side of the family, and that was the last time I seen her.
Do you remember what kinds of games that you were playing with your mom?
Yes, sir. We're playing Jenga, and we're playing Connect Four as well. I think we're playing Life, a couple of different board games.
When your mom dropped you off, can you just describe how that exchange went?
Very emotional. She was very upset. I knew something was off that night. My dad stayed in his vehicle, and they exchanged words across the parking lot. I didn't want to leave her. She was really upset, and I wound up getting in the truck with my dad.
Taylor's testimony introduced the defense's suggestion that perhaps his father, Brian, was another alternative suspect that could have been the killer that night. On cross-examination, they make this theory very clear by focusing on Brian's alibi, the Azteca Mexican restaurant.
The Azteca restaurant is actually very close in proximity to your mom's house, is it not?
Yes, sir.
Very close.
Yes, sir.
Now, you say when you got home that evening, do you know when you got home?
I don't recall.
Don't recall the exact time?
Yes, sir.
But you just recall that your dad went upstairs?
Yes, sir.
And nobody saw him after that?
Yes, sir.
That's all the questions I have.
Both attorneys wrapped up their cases and prepared for their closing arguments. The state prosecutor went first and highlighted that despite the questions surrounding the DNA results, there was enough substantial evidence that identified Russell as the killer. For instance, the inconsistencies in his story throughout the police interrogations, coupled with his efforts to intimidate Melissa prior to her tragic death, and the surveillance footage of him and his brother at the nearby Walmart. He also attributed Russell's physical stature and military background as contributing factors that enabled him to inflict stab wounds that led to her death. The defense attorney contended that the prosecutors failed to provide a motive for the murder. There was no indication that Russell had benefited from the death of Brian Howard's ex-wife, highlighting that the state had yet to establish the identity of Melissa's killer. On February 27, 2019, Russell Holbrook was read his verdict.
Court will publish the verdict at this time. The defendant will rise.
We, the jury, find as follows as to the offense charged in the indictment, guilty of first-degree premeditated murder as charged in the indictment. So say we all this 27th day of February 2019.
Russell Holbrook was convicted of the first-degree murder of Melissa Howard. He was sentenced to life in prison in the state of Florida Department of Corrections. After the final verdict, Melissa's family and the detectives who worked on the case continue to have suspicions that Russell may not have acted alone. That brings us right back to the interrogation footage at the beginning of this video. The person in this footage is actually Jordan Victoria Howard, the new wife of Brian Howard. This interview took place just 3 months after Russell's conviction.
So, Ms. Howard, what brings you here?
I'm scared that my husband's going to kill me.
Okay. And your husband is?
Brian Howard.
The lead detective of the Melissa Howard case, Megan Palumbo, was immediately brought into the room to help with the questioning.
We know what happened in 2006, so we don't want that to happen to you, okay? And we can't undo that, but we can try to fix this.
So you're just afraid?
I know that he killed Melissa. I know that he did that. I know that he'll do that.
Whoa. How do you know that?
Because I know.
All right, you're making a comment. How do you know?
Because he told me.
He didn't tell me that Russell's the one that actually did it. Mm-hmm. He said some other name, I'm sure, just to cover Russell.
Okay.
But he told me that he hired someone to do it.
Jordan claimed that Brian had arranged for someone else to kill Melissa. Brian Howard was later arrested and convicted of a misdemeanor charge of domestic abuse. He continues to deny any involvement in his ex-wife's murder. Neither he nor Michael have been charged in that case, as Russell remains behind bars for life.